This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Amanda Aronchik,
who reports on health for WNYC, sitting in for Brooke this week to focus on infection.
The level of alarm is extremely high.
New concerns this morning after the first measles death in this country in more than a decade.
We have news tonight about the explosion of the West Nile virus.
So far in the U.S., there are more than 30 cases detected in 11 states and the District of Columbia.
41 people have died, and infections are multiplying at four times the usual rate.
This is the deadliest outbreak on record.
While political rhetoric focuses on phony threats from asylum seekers and undocumented workers, at any moment, our security is genuinely vulnerable to other outsiders, namely pathogens, microorganisms that cause deadly infectious diseases. Some threats to the American public are overblown, as we shall see. For instance, the Ebola outbreak that ravaged pockets of West Africa and set off a panic when it crossed our borders claimed only a few victims here. On the other hand, sometimes the alarm is all too justified. We are now marking the 100th anniversary of the 1918 flu pandemic, which was a global catastrophe, claiming between 50 million and 100 million lives.
Scientists are unequivocal. Like a 100-year storm, another pandemic is inevitable. And so, in the centenary of the 1918 flu, this week we look at our vulnerability, which depends not only on vaccines and antibiotics and other scientific knowledge, but on politics, messaging, and public trust. At a historical moment when no fact is immune from political spin and science itself is under attack, how will medical knowledge, human nature, fake news, dark politics, and the lessons of history converge to determine our fate? We begin with the flu of a century ago, a world event so cataclysmic that over the years its enormity grows and grows, as if the pile of dead bodies itself is mounting over time.
All the numbers that have been attached to the size of the death toll of this pandemic were based on extrapolations from what was known in the few parts of the world that had record-keeping and health departments to do that sort of thing.
Lori Garrett is a science journalist and the author of The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance.
So that was the official tally for most of the 20th century. And then people started thinking, wait a second, there were cases in China, which was a huge country. There were cases in India, which was a huge country. How come we don't have any numbers? And it's actually not until pretty much the end of the 20th century that you start to have really scrupulous attempts to figure out how massive had the global toll been. And then the toll starts to jack up to somewhere between 75 and 100 million. I mean, there's whole parts of the planet that weren't even counted, like most of Africa. As far as we can tell, there was no place on Earth that missed the 1918 flu.
For more than a year, the flu was the overarching reality of daily life on Earth.
There are any number of reports to be found where an individual got on the subway in Coney Island and was dead by the time they reached the Upper East Side. It was hemorrhagic. People's bodies turned black. They had internal bleeding. They coughed up blood.
As if the brutal violence to the body wasn't enough, the pandemic came at the tail end of the First World War, what was then the world's deadliest.
So there already was a sense of trauma and grief going on in the background. Along comes this plague. My uncle was a five-year-old when the epidemic started in Baltimore. All the schools were closed in Baltimore, and his father ordered all the children to remain inside the house until whatever this is ends. So for months, they were locked basically inside the home. And his job as a little boy was to sit in a certain place by the front window and keep a log of hearses coming down the street and see if you can identify how many caskets were pulled out of the neighbors' houses. Imagine, that was his job.
And yet, incredibly, unimaginable as it may seem in today's breathless, hype-filled media environment, the overarching story of life on Earth wasn't big news.
It's interesting because as the flu rolled out across the nation, it's remarkable when you go through old newspapers to see how little coverage it actually got. And I think everybody who's ever dug into the history of 1918 has been struck by this. There's only a few newspapers that were really dedicated to the story. And of course, there was no such thing as a science reporter or a health reporter. These were written by the same guy who yesterday was covering a brawl in a high school gym, you know?
And so while countless families were burying the dead, even the yellowest of the yellow press were burying the lead.
You have to wonder, had an epidemic like that occurred without the competition from the war, that it would have had more attention.
Nancy Toms is a historian and author of The Gospel of Germs, Men, Women, and the Microbe in American Life. I asked her, given that these were the Wild West days of Pulitzer and Hearst, was the coverage responsible?
My sense is that given the potential to play the yellow journalism card here, that the coverage of the epidemic was relatively restrained. That's not to say there wasn't criticism published of specific acts. The Commissioner of Health in New York City, you know, there's some grumbling. He does this, he does that. But the sensationalism was on the strictly political side, machine politics, setting Tammany Hall against this, that reformer, that kind of political fodder, and less making a sensational bid to undermine the authority of a public health department.
What were people told to do to manage the spread of the infection?
In fact, the basic tools of managing an influenza epidemic were taken out of the tuberculosis toolkit. You can kind of take posters that were anti-tuberculosis posters, and you see them just being retrofitted with "be careful of how you sneeze to avoid getting the flu." But tuberculosis is not highly contagious. So with an influenza epidemic, because it is so much more contagious, really the smartest thing you can do and still do is to stay home.
I want to ask you about the mechanics of public health messaging. What did the public health authorities do to tell you to quarantine the ill, to tell you not to cough in somebody else's face, to get this information out?
So they were borrowing a lot from the American advertising in this time period. So they would try to come up with an ad equivalent for cover your mouth when you cough or don't spit on the sidewalks. They also did as much as they possibly could education. So little kids start to get this kind of training. There are these hysterical photos you can find of little kids being put through a handkerchief drill, you know, to teach them how to sneeze right. If someone did get sick in your family and you were, you know, working class immigrant, you would get a public health nurse sent to you. And that nurse would explain a lot of this stuff to you.
There are a number of historical watersheds that are deemed to have changed the society. Did the flu pandemic of 1918 change American society?
Now, this has been a big bone of contention because there's a famous book about the pandemic that basically said it was repressed. It was extremely traumatic. I can remember members of my family talking about it, experiencing it. So it wasn't like it disappeared entirely. But there's just so much going on. Seeing all of these young people die, how that intersects with stories about veterans coming back and discussing what it was like fighting in the trenches. So I think it all gets kind of muddled up in a way that makes it hard to pull out the influenza as a cause by itself.
Nancy, thank you.
You're welcome. Take care.
Professor Nancy Toms is a historian of health and health care at Stony Brook University.
It was in 1919. Yes, men and women was dying with that stuff, which the doctors call the flu.
Coming up, overreaction and underreaction.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Progressive Insurance with a Name Your Price tool, providing information on a range of insurance coverage and price options. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Amanda Aronchik.
And I'm Bob Garfield. If it has somehow vanished in the collective memory, 1918 is never far from the thoughts and nightmares of the stewards of public health. And when danger emerges, they feel an obvious urgency to get their response right. They're not always successful. Toward the end of the Gerald Ford administration came one such moment. Again, it arrived in the immediate aftermath of a cruel war, Vietnam. Not a war in which the infection spread, but one which left the public wary of government claims, motives, and intervention.
Today, there is news of a new and potentially very dangerous influenza strain. Health officials say it may be related to the strain that killed so many people in 1918.
This was early 1976. Dr. Harvey Feinberg, former dean of the Harvard School of Public Health, recalls that it was a winter of bitter cold.
A number of soldiers at Fort Dix in January and February of 1976 came down with an illness.
Four soldiers out of several hundred who were tested were infected by a peculiar flu virus.
One of them got out of his sick bed, went on a forced march, and then collapsed and died. This turned out, on further examination at the Centers for Disease Control, to be the swine flu virus, the same type that had caused the great pandemic of 1918-19.
Feinberg knows every detail. As co-author of the government's report, The Swine Flu Affair, Decision-Making on a Slippery Disease, it fell to him to document the 1976 lethal pandemic that wasn't. It turned out to be an unprecedented national public health mobilization for an infection that never spread. Within weeks of the Fort Dix death, the government commissioned mass production of a flu vaccine, while public health officials embarked on an equally massive campaign to inform folks that, yeah, it's the swine flu, it's bad, and it is truly contagious.
Joe brought it home from the office. He gave it to Betty and one of his kids and to Betty's mother. But Betty's mother went back to California the next day. On her way to the airport, she gave it to a cab driver.
Look, here's President Ford himself rolling up his sleeves for the White House position.
Yeah, it's all done.
All set.
And he didn't wait.
No, didn't even know it.
What a trooper. In 10 weeks' time, 45 million more Americans got flu shots. The good news is that the Fort Dix flu never left Fort Dix. The bad news was that a wary post-Vietnam public was left once again to doubt the government in a matter of life and death. Harvey Feinberg says it came down to the complexities of both risk assessment and intervention.
You could think of it as a kind of insurance scheme, but the decision at the time didn't separate that insurance of producing the vaccine from the decision to go ahead and try to immunize all of the American public.
There's the difference between the odds and the level of risk, right? If the chances of an event are relatively small, but the risk is unthinkable, governments are obliged to be on the safe side. you personally are never going to be in a hijacked airplane that's flown into a building, but you still have to remove your belt and shoes when you fly, and so do hundreds of millions of other people who are also not going to be in a hijacked airplane. It's a cost-benefit ratio, no?
There is a difference, an important difference, between the likelihood that something will occur and the severity of the event if it does occur. Interestingly, at the time, there was no effort to be explicit about these assumptions. And part of what made it difficult over months was that they never asked themselves the question, if it changed, what would lead us to do something other than what we are now on a course to do?
Officials at the CDC and in the White House certainly understood the Chicken Little effect, which is to say, when the government does take drastic measures just in case, if the sky doesn't fall, a pandemic doesn't materialize, they're perceived to have overreacted. So if they fail, they fail. If they succeed, they fail.
You're right. In fact, some people have even said if there had been a pandemic that year, public health authorities would have been faulted for not having done enough to actually get the vaccine soon enough. There is a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't character to these decisions. In the end, in public health, you weigh very heavily the protection of the public against this risk of reputation or future credibility. But one of the lessons of the swine flu affair was that long-term credibility also matters.
The New York Times wrote a story, two of the three major networks reported, on something that happened early on, a government announcement about a potential health crisis related to swine flu. Based on what the government told them, were they responsible in the reporting? Were they hysterical? How would you characterize the immediate reaction from the press?
What was especially fascinating at the time was the different ways in which the several news networks went about investigating the background for the story. John Cochrane at NBC News was the lead in looking into the question of what's behind this announcement that there's going to be a serious pandemic and the government has to do something. He used his White House connections to talk to many of the officials at the White House, and he found none of them enthusiastic about this. And he concluded that the politicians were forced to do the bidding of the scientific and health experts. The other approach was Robert Pierpont at CBS, who received a call from his Atlanta bureau that there was dissent within the Centers for Disease Control. And he talked to experts within the CDC, a number of whom told him that the decision to go ahead and announce a mass vaccination program was premature and unwise. So he concluded that there must have been a political motive. This was, after all, an election year, and that there was something other than the science that was driving this choice. And it's fascinating when you review the actual coverage through the year that the difference in perspective framed at the outset persisted throughout the entire coverage of this story. NBC, much more sympathetic to government. CBS, much more critical of the policy choice.
You know, we talked about another fable, Chicken Little. This one's the blind man and the elephant. The reporting was skewed based on which beat the reporters were on and who they were accustomed to talking to.
It's a cautionary tale for journalists not to leap to their own conclusions based on talking only to one side of the argument. And here, in a way, both were legitimate. It is true, most government officials were very reluctant. Many experts within the CDC felt it was as yet unjustified. But the leadership of the public health establishment, the head of CDC, the secretaries, assistant secretaries in what was then health, education, welfare, they felt compelled to protect the public. It was not a political decision. Dick Neustadt and I, who did a review for then the new secretary, Joe Califano, looking at this episode in the immediate aftermath, could find no basis for a political motive in these decisions. And in fact, it's not clear what the right choice is from a political point of view.
You've mentioned that there were false assumptions made at the time based on insufficient data, and they went for an all-in strategy to address what turned out to be a minor outbreak. But the question is, did public health and government officials act correctly based on their lousy data? Did they act incorrectly? I guess what I'm asking is, did they blow it?
I do think that things could have been done better, and they could have been done better in five ways. First, they could have done better at laying the base for program review, being more explicit about what assumptions they were making and when they could revisit those choices. Secondly, they could have been more realistic about the implementation. They never, for example, got the U.S. military involved in thinking about logistics of immunizing that number of people in that short a time. Third, they didn't manage the media with great skill. Most of the leaders at the time were people who had grown up in the print media era, and they were not as well equipped to deal with television. Fourth, they didn't weigh enough the credibility in the long term for public health to have continuing effect on the public. And finally, they did make assumptions about the virus and about the epidemiology of the virus that were not adequately scrutinized. So yes, things could have been done better, but at the heat of the moment, certain actions had to be taken. The key was discriminating between the things you had to do to prepare, to get the insurance laid, to be ready to immunize, and making the decision, separating the decision to actually begin that process based on what more you could learn.
Harvey, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
Dr. Harvey Fineberg is a physician, the president of the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, and the author of The Swine Flu Affair, Decision-Making on a Slippery Disease.
Dr. Fineberg's report said that in the end, the politicians were just trying to do right by the public. Sure, there were missteps, but they were in good faith, not cynical plays for political gain. The same, however, cannot be said for 2014. That summer, there were two competing news stories, a highly contested midterm election, and a surprisingly large outbreak of Ebola in West Africa. Matthew Gertz, a senior fellow at Media Matters, was watching both and started seeing something peculiar in that Ebola coverage. There was rising fear of an outbreak, not there, but here.
I first started noticing this in August of 2014.
Kent Brantley knew the danger, but when an Ebola outbreak hit Liberia earlier this year, the 33-year-old doctor from Indianapolis stayed to fight it, as did Nancy Reipel, a hygienist from Charlotte.
You had two American missionaries who had been in West Africa, who had somehow caught Ebola and were brought back to U.S. medical facilities to be treated.
Well, Richard, very hopeful news. Jeremy Reitbold just spoke to his dad this morning, and the words they're using are cautiously optimistic.
I prayed that God would help me be faithful, even in my illness.
And around that time, you saw a sort of increasing attention to the disease, not in so much as it was a lethal threat to lots of people in West Africa, but as to whether it was a danger to people here in the United States.
On Wall Street, U.S. airline stocks took a tumble today amid renewed fears that Ebola could spread via air travel.
And that ebbed and flowed, but then really picked up in October of 2014. And that's when we saw several medical personnel here in the United States who would come back, catch the disease, be diagnosed, and then an ocean of coverage followed that.
We're deeply concerned by the news that a healthcare worker in Texas has tested preliminarily positive for infection with Ebola virus.
This is a very dangerous infection, and every medical person who takes care of these people understands that there's a risk, even if you are perfect in using all the gear.
Goggles, masks, hoods, two pairs of gloves, one is nitrile and the other one is latex, rubber boots.
Yesterday we announced that a patient at Bellevue Hospital had tested positive for Ebola. I want to repeat what I said last night. There is no cause for everyday New Yorkers to be alarmed.
This was when Donald Trump really entered the story.
Donald Trump is blaming the commander-in-chief for bringing Ebola to New York City. Shortly after Dr. Spencer...
When the missionaries were being transported back to the United States, he issued a series of tweets warning that it was a danger to the country.
Over the weekend, Trump tweeted, "The U.S. cannot allow Ebola-infected people back. People that go to faraway places to help out are great, but must suffer the consequences." He also tweeted, "The fact that we are taking the Ebola patients while others from the area are fleeing to the United States is absolutely crazy."
And the White House later reviewed this and ended up concluding that Trump's tweets were a decisive turning point, that they started this process by which the American public was becoming increasingly fearful of their own safety around Ebola. It didn't stop there, of course. He ended up tweeting about Ebola nearly 100 times over the next 3 months going through the election, and was among the first to call for a big travel ban between those West African countries and the United States, which we later saw picked up by Republicans who were running for elections that fall.
And why do you think that those tweets were so effective?
You know, I think it's because they were making points that no one else was, because the points were very bad ones. The expert consensus around this was you should try very hard not to stigmatize people who are trying to provide aid to these countries. You want to make sure that you don't have these sorts of travel bans, because that will make the problem substantially worse.
I went back and looked at the coverage, and at the time, public experts are making it very clear that there is no chance of a widespread Ebola outbreak in America. Why do you think that that rational, science-based message was completely drowned out?
I think it's difficult when you have this sort of news apparatus where you have a CDC expert coming on and explaining calmly and rationally, this is a serious disease, but we have the situation well in hand.
Ebola spreads only by direct contact with a patient who is sick with the disease or has died from it, or with their body fluids.
And then the next segment is somebody claiming that ISIS terrorists, all they have to do is go over to an Ebola-infected zone, get themselves infected, and then somehow come to the United States and get on a subway, and they'd be able to have this massive impact and kill lots of people.
Outnumbered ISIS terrorists now reportedly urging supporters to use a new weapon to kill us Westerners, Ebola.
All ISIS would need to do is send a few of its suicide killers into an Ebola-affected zone and then get them on some mass transit somewhere where they would need to be to affect the most damage. That's what you're referring to. Yes.
The way in which serious news coverage and this sort of infotainment schlock journalism gets put back to back, I think, can't help but really confuse the public about what's going on.
Now, you found that there were nearly 1,000 news segments about Ebola in the month before the 2014 midterms. And then in the 2 weeks following the elections, there are just 50 news segments. Is that because the outbreak is over?
What I think this data really shows is the confluence of media coverage and political gamesmanship. The Republicans made a very public effort to turn Ebola into a major political story. They wanted to create the sense that the Obama administration was endangering the public, that their careful consultations with experts and their attempt to try to find solutions without stampeding into massive travel bans or anything like that was going to get people killed. And I think the media, to an extent, played along with that. And then immediately after the elections, when, you know, for all intents and purposes, there was nothing for Republicans to get out of the story, they had already won, they stopped talking about it, the press stopped talking about it, and the story went away. I think the takeaway was that you can fearmonger like this and be very successful in American politics. And I think that's a very dangerous message.
Matthew Goertz, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Matthew Goertz is a senior fellow at Media Matters. It's not always fear-mongering. Sometimes it's the real deal.
For example, the 2003 SARS epidemic, which killed hundreds of travelers so fast, it all but shut down the Asian airline industry as public worry turned into debilitating fear almost overnight. In a global world connected by air travel, authorities constantly face the difficulty of knowing the difference between a lethal threat and the sniffles. 15 years ago, there was an outbreak that dramatized just how hard it is to identify disease, much less contain it.
Hiya.
Is this Dr. Leung?
Yeah, this is the elusive Dr. Leung.
With that in mind, let me tell you about a man who came to New York with a very deadly disease, although he didn't know it at the time. This is the story of Dr. Ho Nam Leung.
I was impressed that you found me. I thought you would have been buried in history forever.
Dr. Leung is an infectious disease specialist based in Singapore. It started in the spring of 2003 when he saw a new patient.
I was consulted on this unusual pneumonia in a girl who has just returned from travel.
She'd been shopping in Hong Kong. He would check on her often in the hospital, but she wasn't improving.
We were very limited in our testing abilities then, and we couldn't figure out what she had.
It was still a mystery when a few days later, Dr. Leung boarded a flight with his family to attend a conference in Manhattan.
We landed early in the morning in New York, and we said we're going to keep awake, so we're going to try to beat the jet lag.
They take a shuttle to the hotel, get changed, wander through Chinatown, eat at a restaurant. Then the conference was scheduled to start.
So I went back to the hotel in the late afternoon. That's when I realized that something wasn't quite right. I had chills. I knew I was sick.
The next day, he went to the hospital. They didn't know what he had. This is one of several moments when Dr. Leung fell through the cracks. The hospital could have forbidden him from traveling, but they didn't. And he just wanted to go back to Singapore.
Why did you think it would be easier to go home?
I guess we are always terrified about the unnecessary costs of medicine in US.
Aha.
The bills can be quite exorbitant.
So they cut their trip short and get back on a plane. They're halfway across the Atlantic when airline staff come looking for Dr. Leung.
They quickly identified me and say they've received instructions from the Ministry of Health in Singapore to quarantine us at the rear of the plane.
The crew doesn't know why exactly, but they've been told to quarantine Dr. Leung and his family.
They moved everyone from the rear of the plane forward, leaving only 3 to 4 rows of seats at the rear.
Then at the first stopover in Frankfurt,
they took everyone off the plane. First the passengers, followed by the staff, and they came to get me.
The Centers for Disease Control today issued a health warning for Americans following a worldwide outbreak of a mysterious form of pneumonia.
News broke. A new virus was discovered in Hong Kong, and they're naming it SARS.
Severe acute respiratory syndrome.
Then I started realizing that we might be at the brink of a new epidemic.
Today, a surgeon is under quarantine in a German hospital. The doctor had treated a person with the disease in Singapore this week, then flew to New York for a medical conference.
Dr. Leung was Singapore's patient number 3. He'd caught the virus from that young woman, the one who had just returned from Hong Kong. He became very ill, and he thought he might die.
German health officials said today the condition of a Singapore doctor believed to have been infected with the mysterious pneumonia-like illness has worsened.
In 2003, over 8,000 people worldwide contracted SARS, and it killed nearly 1 in 10 of those infected. In traveling to that conference, Dr. Leung could have caused an outbreak in New York City.
Who should have stopped you? Should it have been the airline? Should it have been the authorities in Singapore? Should it have been the authorities in New York?
I think everyone has a role to play.
His hospital in Singapore should have been more cautious. He should have been flagged by the doctors in New York. And he should have known not to fly. After all, he is a specialist in infectious disease.
Now, looking back at what you did, do you feel badly? Like, should you have stopped yourself?
I feel stupid. I honestly feel stupid. I say I shouldn't have boarded the plane.
He was not alone. SARS spread, in many cases by air travel, to over 25 countries.
Flash forward to September 5th of this year, when a pilot on a 14-hour flight from Dubai to New York called officials at JFK Airport to say there seemed to be a lot of sick people on this plane.
Dubai landed at JFK Wednesday morning to a cluster of flashing lights, paramedics, and law enforcement waiting for them on the tarmac.
Dozens of emergency vehicles met the plane away from the terminal. The Centers for Disease Control wouldn't let anyone off.
At first, people were really calm and patient. And then after, you know, 20 minutes of no information, no water, the bathrooms were unusable by the end, people got really frustrated.
Passengers told Fox 5 News it was the flight from hell. There was coughing, sneezing, everyone had their temperature taken. After 2.5 hours on the tarmac, they were finally released.
Where they met their families and a mob of TV cameras.
Good afternoon.
5 hours later, the Department of Health held a press conference.
This was a flight that had 521 passengers. 106 of them presented with symptoms ranging from cough, fever, vomiting.
But over the course of the day, that number went down a lot. Just 11 people went to the hospital. Some had a minor flu. Others just had a common cold. Mostly people thought they were sick. So what happened here?
It doesn't make sense. Sometimes the symptoms themselves become contagious. We see this a lot, like in high school, one person vomits and then the rest of them start vomiting.
Dr. Amish Adelja is at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Basically, people got scared and freaked out.
Fear is contagious, so I guess that's what ends up happening, which is the tagline from Contagion, I think, right?
It's actually nothing spreads like fear. The question is, did this fear cause the public health officials and the airline to overreact?
And I do believe that what that pilot did on the Emirates flight was right.
As inconvenient as this flight from hell was for the passengers, it's thanks to SARS that there are systems in place. Sick passengers, alert pilot, the CDC awaiting the plane on the tarmac. Now, if only containing the fear was so easy.
Coming up, when life or death may hinge on who do you trust?
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Amanda Aronchik.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Another flu season is upon us, another set of reminders to get your vaccination, and once again, another season of public complacency.
I just want to ask you guys if you've had the flu shot this year.
Not yet.
No, I just didn't get it. I'll go get it.
Got it. How about you? Flu shot? Yay or nay?
I think I've gotten it, no.
It is one of the paradoxes of pathogenesis. The public that can be terrified can also be impassive. One minute in a panic, the next in denial. Why the lack of urgency? The answer may reside in a 2017 study by the Pew Research Center on public trust for various institutions of society. It found that 55% of Americans hold a lot of trust in information from medical scientists. But conversely, of course, that's 45% who do not have a lot of trust. Moreover, the percentage with a lot of trust in medical information from the pharmaceutical industry is 13%. The news media, 8%. Elected officials, 6%. These results paralleled other surveys revealing plummeting levels of faith in American institutions in general.
The new Edelman Trust Barometer survey shows a whopping 37% drop last year in trust among Americans in government, media, business, and non-government organizations. Basically, everybody in power, nobody trusts them.
These are problematic findings under any circumstances. But in the face of the next pandemic, what might the public be told? What might it believe or disbelieve to make matters worse? Well, at least one expert says, don't panic about that. Professor Dominique Brassard chairs the Department of Life Sciences Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She researches public perception and messaging over infectious disease outbreaks, and she says that when push comes to shove, we do manage to act correctly based on sources we do trust. Her research is built on an analysis tool called SARF.
A social amplification of risk framework. What media tells us about what's happening in society is what most likely we will rely on to form an attitude combined with our background, our knowledge of the issue, and so on. So you have the real crisis event, which is the pathogen, and then you will have what we call amplification stations. Media will report with headlines that are sensational, that exaggerate the risk and so on, or downplay the risk. We talk to colleagues, we talk to our family. All those are amplification stations that may distort what the media had said. So when we think about public opinion, we need to remember that all those amplification stations are all around us in our social context, telling us those stories about risk and how we should feel about them.
All right. Let's start with H1N1, a variant of the virus that caused the 1918 pandemic. In 2009, the World Health Organization declared a pandemic for that year's version of H1N1. What did the messaging look like in 2009?
Americans were following very closely what was going on. But the news report covering the swine flu outbreak and the availability of a vaccine made Americans confident that the government was able to handle the outbreak. And that's partly due to the fact that there was a distribution of antiviral drugs and that there was a development of vaccine in the making that contributed to this.
They didn't worry much. The CDC's got our backs. We're good. But
yeah.
Then the numbers of cases and the numbers of deaths began to take off. What happened then?
By the end of the last reported poll around that time, only 51% of people had the similar levels of confidence from the beginning. So yes, indeed, public confidence can change depending of how an agency handles the disease or the potential outbreaks.
All right, that's H1N1. As we've heard earlier in the show, very different narrative for Ebola. The CDC, in many respects, hit it right on the nose that Ebola, while highly contagious with personal contact, you know, you're not going to get it because somebody sneezes, and therefore it's not likely to create any kind of widespread outbreak. What could the CDC have done differently?
In crisis communication, we always say whoever's at the floor and send their message will win the messaging battle. The problem is the CDC was absent until later on. I think the CDC could have been more active in issuing some press releases to the media, you know, updates on what was going on overseas. It's kind of strange, though, because it's not their mandate. They're supposed to keep the American public safe. Although in international media, we were seeing extensive coverage of the Ebola crisis, we were not seeing it in the American reporting because nobody was feeding them to them. There was what we called an episodic coverage in media that was related to events, right? So when the Ebola case happened in the United States, that gave plenty of food for reporters to write stories, but not in what we call a thematic way, not talking about the disease, preparing the American public, understanding what that disease is about, what were the type of contagious factors and so on. So I think it was the sudden arrival and the short time frame that made the CDC more vulnerable when they could have prepared beforehand to potentially handle the crisis.
You take heart in 2016, the Zika outbreak, a mosquito-borne disease and another ghastly one, which seemed to be moving northward from Latin America like killer bees or migrant caravans to invade our placid republic. In this case, unlike H1N1, as the days and weeks passed, confidence in authorities grew. Why?
Indeed, confidence on the CDC and other organizations that are supposed to make us safe can come back when the agencies handle a crisis very well. If you look at media coverage of the Zika pandemic, at the end of 2015 already, there was some reporting what was going on in Brazil was discussed. The different type of research that was going on was also reported. So I think in the Zika context, people were following very closely what was going on. The CDC messaging was much more consistent and was much more spread than on the Ebola context. And this all contributed in increasing confidence from the American public. We saw that some news organizations in Florida actually did a good job doing what we call in communication thematic reporting, not just focusing on events-based, but giving some background that will tell the readers what exactly is going on.
Yeah, we call it context.
That's a good way to do it.
And that is sometimes absent.
Yes.
So far, we've been discussing infectious disease. I want to turn for a moment to the flip side of that, the subject of vaccines. We are, and have been for the past 5 years or so, in the midst of hysteria, resulting in measurably bad public health outcomes. I'm speaking of the anti-vax movement. What has this done to the trust equation in all matters of infectious disease?
What is clear is that the first mistake that we're making is just assuming that concerns of some people are not valid. When if you have a mother that's concerned about vaccines, well, a concern is a concern. We cannot say that the concern is not valid. We can say there may not be scientific evidence to support it, but I hear you. We know by research that people won't change their attitude just based on the facts. We need to appeal to other type of dimensions. As you, a journalist, you will bring a human interest angle to your story. You're going to put a face on this, you know, sick child. How can we use narratives to tell that stories that would persuade people to listen to science, since we know that they don't listen just to statistic and scientific facts?
Well, and to be fair, Big Pharma has a lot to answer for. Fudged research, suppressed research, illegal marketing, which brings up the question, faced with a 1918 scale pandemic, were pharma and the government able to develop and manufacture a vaccine quickly? Do you have confidence that enough of the public would be confident to take its medicine to prevent catastrophe?
I mean, you saw what happened with all the recalled letters in supermarkets recently,
yes.
Right? Right. And you know what the American public did? They all throw out the letters. They all actually make sure they were not eating that lettuce.
So you're saying, remember the romaine.
Exactly. Remember the romaine.
All right. Dominique, many thanks.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Dominique Brassard is the chair of the Department of Life Sciences Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. What Professor Brassard has to say is encouraging, I suppose. Remember the romaine is a pretty good slogan, and we didn't all get poisoned by E. coli. But it cannot be the last word, partly because lost trust is not all about rhetoric. The public has seen what it has seen. It has watched the government lie over Vietnam and Iraq and watched the media credulously pass on those lies. It's watched public health officials botch the supposed killer flu of 1976 and the Ebola outbreak of 2014. It has watched Big Pharma rush bad drugs and devices to market, sometimes on the basis of fudged or cherry-picked scientific data. It has watched researchers bribed by industry and medical journals print research ghostwritten by drug companies. Is there a trust gap? Of course there's a trust gap. And where the flu is concerned, the untrusting don't know the half of it. Scientists may be quick to identify new strains and design vaccines accordingly, but if we must inoculate 330 million Americans, much less the whole world, author Laurie Garrett tells us the infrastructure is unequal to the task.
There are only a handful of vaccine manufacturers on the planet. They are, of course, concentrated in North America and Europe. We still can't even begin to make 1 billion doses of vaccine in a timely manner. In fact, we barely can make 500 million doses, and we have more than 7 billion Homo sapiens.
Which means, of course, choices will have to be made. Triage on a grand scale based on what? Garrett says, you know exactly what.
The answer is, you know, if you're on that continent, screw you. If you're on this continent, okay, get in line. You're in the rich world. You get first access.
That's the never-ending story. In an increasingly nationalistic world, one hostile to so many categories of powerlessness, what she describes is pathogenocide.
As populism rises, the social order is breaking down. It's getting harder and harder to have a sense of solidarity in the face of a microbial threat, and harder to have a sense of shared sacrifice, shared needs, shared threat. And we're in this really sickening situation now where the conspiracy, if you will, of profit motive and populism is imperiling all our health. And I don't have a solution for that.
These are the stakes. If we're considering risk and behavior in the midst of contagion, it's not just the nature of the next pathogen, it's also the nature of the society in which it spreads. As we gird for the next onslaught, whenever that may come, we must also contend with the plague of suspicion buried deep within ourselves. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Feder, and Asta Chaturvedi. But this week's show was produced by my co-host, Amanda Aronchik, with help from Allison Light. We had more help from Samantha Maldonado. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios.
This week's show is part of Germ City, a series produced by the WNYC Newsroom and a collaboration with the Museum of the City of New York and New York Academy of Medicine. Visit wnyc.org/germcity for more stories.
Thanks to you, Amanda.
Thank you, Bob.
Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.